Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. We hope this message finds you well. We hope this message finds you comfortable, especially in your undergarments. I'm Ben. That's our super producer, Max Williams, who I just met today.
I know.
Right?
It's true. And, you know, and speaking of being comfortable, we're all comfortable, cozied up in a studio, in person.
In person.
All three of us.
Mm-hmm. And
weird. I'm Noel, by the way.
You're Noel, yeah. And in a way, we're a company not just with you, fellow Ridiculous Historians, but with our pals Josh and Chuck, because we have poached their studio. It is festooned with fan art from the one and only Coop. Aaron Cooper.
Right? Uh-huh, I know the guy. I know him well. He's a good dude and a master of Photoshoppery.
He is indeed. We astute listeners may wonder why we said, well, hope you're comfortable, especially in your undergarments.
Yeah, you're like, whoa, hey, why are you getting all up in my little Australia? That's your phrase, Ben. I stole it.
It's weird because, you know, we talked about this in the past when we did an episode on bidets, which was a lot of fun. We decided to lean into this one, didn't we, Noel? We have been hanging out with the people at Fruit of the Loom.
Mm-hmm. Lovely people.
And they asked us a little bit about the history of underwear.
You'd think they'd know about it, but they asked us to help, you know, fill in some gaps for them, I think.
They came to us to put the pieces together. And I don't know if they knew just how exciting these kind of topics are for us.
Oh, God. I mean, the most exciting. It turns out that the history of undergarments goes back way further than I think either of us realize.
So far back, man. And also, the history of undergarments is kind of also a history of fashion, a history of sexual liberation, of sanitation. Max Williams plays a huge role in this. I had no idea, Max, how instrumental you were. And it's different throwing you under the bus in person.
It's a lot different getting thrown under the bus in person. Like, normally I can just, like, turn my, like, camera off or just, like, be like, oh, I guys have to do something else. But I'm just sitting right here. You know I'm not doing anything else.
We're going to make, hey, Noel, what if we make some Max facts in the show?
Oh, we have to.
Why am I getting the Jonathan Strickland treatement right now?
No.
I'll have to say it two more times and he'll show up, right?
Yeah, please don't.
He is actually here.
He is here.
He is in the building. Yeah, so keep your voices down. But no, there's not even a proper corner in this tiny studio for you to, like, get into a fetal position and cry in.
And, you know, that corner is something I think all three of us came to take for granted, the Zoom corner, being able to turn off your camera. We are live and direct, so we have to stay on our P's and Q's. We're all wearing clothing, and that's something I think that we take for granted, too, especially underwear. It's weird. You can't really talk to people about underwear. Like, if I said, like, Noel has all these great hats, and so I could walk up to Noel, and we know each other very well, and I could be like, oh, hey, man, that's a kick-ass hat. Mm-hmm. Especially, like, we know each other well enough that I know a lot of your hats, so I can tell if there's a new one. But if I was like, hey, man, what kind of undies are you wearing today?
Well, it's funny. Undies have kind of come full circle in an interesting way, because initially, around 7,000 years ago, when the first evidence of undergarments were uncovered, or, you know, from that era, it really was outerwear, because it was the only wear, right? You found evidence of prehistoric humans wearing what are referred to as loincloths, which is like a thin strip of fabric that you'd loop between your legs and cover your naughty bits with, and kind of, you know, cinch around your waist. And it was, I don't know, what do you think, was there a built-in modesty already at that point? Or was it just to protect their bits from, you know, being blanched by the sun? Or what do you think?
Pretty fragile. So I think there's definitely, like, a safety imperative. Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, maybe that becomes modesty. But you're right, it's very much outerwear in the ancient days. They were also leather, too. This was not, you know, this was not an aesthetic thing or a kink. This is just what they had available at the time.
Right.
And it's still a primary form of dress for a lot of people, a lot of indigenous people in warmer climates especially.
Very true. And something I didn't realize, I've heard of the Iceman. Apparently he cometh. His name is Ötzi, and he died in a region known as the Tyrolean Alps in Tyrol, which I believe is in Germany, in that would be modern-day Germany, around 5,000 years ago. And they uncovered his remains and found him wearing a goatskin breech or a loincloth, right?
Real clothes horse, the Iceman.
Because it was so cold, right? He had overwear as well. It was not the same situation as with the prehistoric humans. He had furry kind of leggings on, and they found that underneath that he was wearing this goatskin loincloth.
And didn't he have a cape of some sort, like a cloak?
That I can neither confirm nor deny.
Okay. All right. Well, let's stick to the facts then.
Because his name was the Iceman? He has to have like a...
At this point, we can also see examples of underwear in other parts of the world. If we fast forward about 1,500 years, mm-hmm. then we...
Just a blip just in the historical record.
In the world of podcasting and the historical record. We see that Egypt also had underwear. They had a specific type of linen underwear called a shinti, S-H-E-N-T-I, which was kind of like a loincloth.
Sort of like a brief.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is interesting because if you were the pharaoh, you would, or you know, a higher class person in that society, you would maybe wear a skirt over your shinti. But if you were just the, you know, average day-to-day worker, you would probably just be wearing the shinty. And there's a great article we want to shout out from The Independent, written by Susie Rushton, which goes over so much ancient history of pants. And
pants as in the British pants.
Yes.
Which is underwear.
Yes,
I
mean,
most, I'm sure everybody knows that who watches British comedies, but I always love that pants are underwear.
And trousers are pants. Yeah, yeah. It's an important distinction, right?
Because fanny also means something different.
Totally different. Totally different. And this is a family show, so we're not going to tell you exactly what it is, but you might not want to Google it on your school computer. This is interesting in that we see multiple groups of people, not often without having contact with one another, have been wearing loincloths. It just makes sense. It's the most elegant answer to the question, how do I hide and or protect my stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And then we see this evolution in detail throughout history. I think the there's a little bit of controversy or speculation with the ancient Greeks. There's the idea that loincloths were around in ancient Greece, but only enslaved people wore them.
Interesting. And then the ancient Romans wore the least sexy name for an undergarment you're going to get in this whole show. I almost have a hard time pronouncing it, or at least I had to do a double take when I first read the word. I believe, Ben, it is subligaculum.
Yes.
Who came up with
that? Subligaculum. A Roman with a love of tongue twisters.
I suppose so. And it's sort of an advanced loincloth, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. You got a little more upper thigh coverage. It's kind of, think of them like short shorts,
mm-hmm.
or a loincloth with some added bells and whistles, extra wrapping. And this was, I believe, something that could be worn by anybody, right? It wasn't just for dudes of the day or what have you.
No, and writing over on History Extra, Greg Jenner, who has a really cool website called Horrible Histories, this is in league with the BBC, he also says that this is worn by gladiators and actors, you know, and it was even worn by, there was a version of it for women that he referred to as a boob tube, but he put it in quotes, so he must have gotten it from somewhere. I don't think he made this up, but I love the idea of a boob tube and then, you know, adapting that term to refer to the television, which is, you know, not underwear related at all, but would play a large role in spreading the gospel of underwear, you know, and through advertisement much later in the game.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point. Another cycle or a full circle of history. And if we go to the 13th century, then we see the creation of loose, just pull on underpants. These were baggy. They went down to your calves, so they're you know what? They would look like capri pants mm-hmm. today. That's what you would think of.
Yeah, and they were referred to as drawers, and I've always thought of that as being like, you know,
kind of southern.
Well, yeah, but a drawer. like, you know, a thing you open up and close and put things in. But it actually refers to the drawstrings, as in drawers. You know, you're drawing the drawstrings to cinch them around your waist, right? And that was, yeah, they were called braises, I believe.
Or braise.
That's right. That's right. That's probably its own plural. It's like sheep.
Yeah, yeah. A sheep and those sheep. A braise and those braise. Also, I just love, you know, it's part of our show being based in the southeast of the United States, but we love a good southern accent, and I have had people in my family who do refer to underwear as draws.
Draws. They really draw it out, don't they? And then you sort of had a style on braise called chausses that the upper class would wear, and they were a little more like leg warmers. You know, they would just cover the thigh, up to the thigh, rather.
Yeah, yeah, Iceman style, right?
Exactly.
And then we know that for many people in northern climes, these weren't just worn to protect yourself from, like, hazards of your environment. They were also worn to keep you warm, right?
And let's not forget, there were also, like, armored versions of these things that maybe were made of, like, chainmail or something, for example. And we're going to bounce around ever so slightly here and there. Mainly, it's going to be sort of a linear history of underwear, but we might double back a couple of times. Vikings and Celtics, they also wore those braise, but they wore long socks. And that was because it was cold, like you said, Ben, so they wore those to keep them warm. Romans, however, did not wear socks. That's largely because of the warm temperature. We know that they wore sandals with no socks, because sandals with socks is obviously a total fashion faux pas. Even though it's sort of coming back now, sandals with socks, like, sort of becoming cool again, sort of like Crocs.
Like Outkast. I'm firmly on board.
It's debatable as to whether Crocs are cool or not, but they are definitely making a big comeback.
Max is not on board with this.
He's not on board.
This is a terrible look. I don't
sandals
get
with
it.
Socks or Crocs?
Both. Like, why?
What about
why?
Crocs with socks?
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
In a box.
Are you a shoe supremacist, Max?
No, I am not a shoe supremacist, but, like, it's just like, this is clearly, like, something that's horribly wrong. Unless you're working on a line in a kitchen, you should not wear Crocs, period.
Well, there's all kinds of innovations in Crocs. Like, you have little bedazzly things that you stick in the holes in them.
Sure.
You've got kind of goth Crocs, which are black and have little spikes that come up out of the holes. It's a whole thing. The kids are crazy about them.
Yeah. They became uncool enough to be cool again. It's like normcore.
Exactly. It's that level of irony where eventually it just becomes the thing. Like, you do something ironically long enough, you really just like it.
Next thing. Pleated pants.
100%. And Steely Dan. I mean, Steely Dan used to be dad rock, and now, like, all the new bands sound like Steely Dan. But the Romans looked down upon people who wore socks. In fact, they considered the Vikings and the Celtics to be barbarians. And they really thought that sock wearing was absolutely gauche. More so, even. It was like, oh my God, these animals with their socks.
They had some weird social mores or judgments that definitely didn't age well. But fun etymological note about barbarism and being barbaric, where that comes from is also itself kind of a petty insult or condescension. It just meant people who, like, when Roman forces couldn't understand a native language, they called people barbarians, because in their mind it was onomatopoeia, because everything people said that they didn't understand sounded like bar, 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 bar.
Ermagerd.
Yeah.
Berberism.
Yeah. Berberism.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So we're at the Middle Ages. Humanity's soldiers on.
Blip.
There we are.
There we are.
Magic of time travel. And during this time, there's something that a lot of people might be surprised to learn. Guys were still wearing linen shorts. They were still called braise, but women weren't actually wearing what we would consider underwear, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was actually, I'm speaking to the general zeitgeist of the time, which was very patriarchal and misogynistic. And women who wore underwear were seen as being somewhat low or base, not based, like the kids would say, which means super cool, but, you know, potentially promiscuous. It certainly wasn't seen as a sign of virtue, and virtue was king back then.
Yeah, yeah, very patriarchal. They did not... they were jerks. They were being jerks about it. But the only common underwear for women before the 19th century at this point was something called a shift, or in France would be what, a chemise?
A chemise. Yeah, yeah. You know what it makes me think of, Ben? We both, I think, are big fans of the David Eggers film, The Witch.
The Witch. Yeah, yeah.
And this is a mild spoiler, I guess, but I'm not gonna give the complete context. I'm just gonna read the line. It's "Remove thy shift."
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was so good.
"Wouldst thou like the taste of butter?"
And it's the taste of butter. It's not butter. I remember we had off air when that film came out. We all went and hung out. A good friend of the show, Lauren Vogelbaum, was there, and we talked for like an hour and a half analyzing The Witch.
I saw it with Lauren in the theater, and we both had seen it. We're seeing it for the first time, and we were just like gobsmacked at the end.
Amazing. I got it.
Do you want to live deliciously, Ben?
What's that?
I do want to live. Okay. Yeah. I think we all do.
It's interesting, too, because there's an argument about extremism and radicalization in The Witch. Oh, wait, you know what? We're doing our conversation.
Oh, we're already doing it.
No.
We'll save that for the
underwear,
bar after recording.
We are going to try to take Max out. That is a true story. So there is another thing that occurs in this space that we have to talk about, and that is also the evolution of, you know, I love how you pointed out how dangerously gendered a lot of this was.
Yes.
But there were other things evolving as well, because even though we're saying people identifying as female weren't wearing what we would recognize as modern underwear today, they were wearing things like petticoats or corsets. And then this kind of leads us to eventually, we'll get to it in a little bit, but it leads us to lingerie.
It does eventually, but the version that we're talking about was much more of a imposed kind of dress or a imposed idealization or like the way women should appear. And these petticoats, corsets especially, they were reinforced by things like whalebone or reeds or willow rods to stiffen them. And they wanted to create this almost conical shape. Like we talk about the Barbie doll frame without the bust. That's sort of what it was.
Like the bottom of the hourglass.
Exactly, because the bust was flattened. And if you see these corsets, I mean, there is no plunging neckline at this point. It was very modest and very unpleasant to wear, I can only imagine.
It's tough. I mean, it was around for a while, and it was high fashion, right? It was introduced by Catherine de' Medici into France in the 1500s. It was originally from Italy, but I think it really took off in the European imagination when Queen Elizabeth I started popularizing this idea of the big petticoat and the high and tight corset.
Exactly. The petticoat, and they were supported with these hoops that were kind of concentric circles made of, again, that stiffening material. I think even there were versions of it later when steel became more accessible. This is down the line, but then they became replaced with steel, and they were essentially cages that were covered in fabric. And the more opulent you were, the larger your skirt would be.
Yeah. You know, the bigger you were, the bigger your, we wouldn't say butt at this point, the bigger like your bell was.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And the bigger a deal you were.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about a shift, if you're trying to picture it in your head, you're essentially picturing something that looks like a nightgown.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't think a lot of people wear nightgowns nowadays.
Certainly not the Ebenezer Scrooge style.
With the
hat.
With the
little
tassel,
cap.
Yeah.
That's the nightcap that people speak of so fondly. And I don't understand how late night drink became a nightcap. It's the thing you don donned before bed. I guess that's why it makes sense.
That's a little poetic.
But you're right, Ben. And the shift or chemise really was kind of a nightgown. Men would even wear them, shortened versions. They would tuck them under their genitalia.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have a little extra security there.
Yeah, right.
They always tucked in. The tucking in was huge back then. But this was something that, like, the upper class, for example, would have shifts made of fine linens and silks and things like, maybe not silks yet. I don't know. I forget when the trade led to the availability of silk. That wouldn't have been, I'm not quite sure about the
timeline. But people got into silk underwear. That's true.
1,000,000%. But then the lower class or peasants would have had shifts made of, like, wool, you know, or more rough, itchy kind of material. But one thing that both classes had in common were that these garments were worn repeatedly and they could be washed. And one very popular method for washing these was using stale urine.
Yeah.
Why?
It apparently made things brighter.
Okay.
That was one of the
rationalizations. You think it would make it yellower?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends on the source of the urine, honestly. And also at this time, we should mention the people in both the world of medicine and popular culture had a little bit of a different idea of urine than we do today.
It's true.
Right? A lot of medicine was, here, pee into this vial,
yeah,
or this pee into this container, and I will hold it up to the candlelight or, yes, the sun to determine whether you are melancholic.
Indeed. to gauge the levels of your humors.
Exactly. And so they did, though, side note, because again, these are people just like us listening or doing this show today. They weren't dumb. They were working with what they had, and they didn't want to smell like pee, so they would hang these undergarments outside and try to air dry them long enough,
yeah,
that they didn't smell like pee.
Which probably also means they wore them for quite a long time before they would wash them. Because especially if you were a peasant, you wouldn't have that many of these.
No. And it wasn't until the Middle Ages that it even became a thing and was somewhat of a luxury for a while. Because before that, if you were the average person in this area, you would have either slept naked or you would just sleep in the clothes you had already been wearing. It's not like you had 50 pairs of trousers. You had, you know, you had the good pair and then you had the other pair, maybe. And so you would just leave those on. Nightgowns, because they were made of these thin fabrics originally, you had to be pretty well off to wear them. And then, you know, as we see this catch on with the quote-unquote lower classes, that's where we see the rough wool you're talking about. Yeah. And then, I don't know, let's go back to chausses. Because we mentioned those, and Europe goes into the Renaissance period, and that's when things start getting a little racier.
These were the ruffly capri pants initially, like, you know, the kind of loose fitting. They became, I believe, silk hose, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, gosh, who was it? Queen Elizabeth I as well made a big stand on wearing this silken hose and really popularized it.
So while these tight hose approaches are becoming more in vogue, braids also start to get shorter. And then there's this wonderful innovation that I think we should all appreciate more, the predecessor of the fly. That's right. If you are wearing, if you're wearing pants, you'll often find that there is an opening, especially dudes' pants. You'll find that there's an opening, often with a zipper, sometimes with a button, that allows you to use the restroom without entirely dropping trowel. This flap could be buttoned up because zippers didn't exist yet, or you could tie it closed with like drawstrings. And this was the first ever thing that we called a codpiece. It is not named after fish. A fun, only slightly NSFW fact, cod was a Middle English term for, it was scrotum, right?
Yep.
It's scrotum.
Mm-hmm.
This is my scrotum piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, oh my God. By the way, I said not a dumb thing, I just wasn't sure, and I said as much. Silk was around by the time of the Second Crusade, so they would have had silk, but again, it would have been very rare and coming from afar.
It'd be, you know, for like the king.
Absolutely.
Right.
But then it became a little more available around the time that we're talking about these leggings kind of coming into fashion. But you're right, Ben. The codpiece. You want to talk about syphilis? Is it time?
You know, it's always time to have frank discussions with our friends about important issues. And syphilis is one. This is...
Okay. It was rampant.
Yes, it was, as our friend Frank would say, wide rife.
Wide rife indeed. And it was even... Because you couldn't get rid of it,
right?
So it was even rampant among the upper class. And King Henry VIII, for example, wore a codpiece. And part of the point of the codpiece was the point, literally, to embiggen.
Right.
Embiggen your area.
Like a push-up bra.
100%. Only absurd. I always think of a Clockwork Orange. You know, mm-hmm. They obviously wore it for effect, and it's sort of like a weird retro kind of European callback, I guess, but very odd. But yeah, Henry VIII wore quite a large one. And apparently it was so large because he needed extra room in there to stuff it with ointment-soaked rags.
Like poultices,
basically. Uh-huh. So that it would reduce the pain and swelling he was experiencing was associated with syphilis.
Yeah, and there were other people, because the codpiece wasn't covered by outer layers, right? So there are other people who are stuffing it, whether that's because they've contracted syphilis or whether that's because they want to make more of a visual impression.
Yep.
It probably goes case by case, but that was happening. And
there's some paintings you can look at it from this era.
It's obvious.
They're like shaped like a
like a dong.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Like outwardly.
Yes.
It's like an outward. Yeah. That thing. It's weird. Thank God that fell out of fashion. So strange. I mean, you know, we certainly have instances of like rock stars stuffing their pants with socks and like, you know, I think there was in Spinal Tap where I believe David St. Hubbins is going through security and it keeps. No, I know it is. It's Derek Smalls, the bassist. He's going through security and he keeps setting off the metal detector and he pulls out a cucumber wrapped in tinfoil out of his pants and shamefully turns it over to the airport security.
And other dudes in other parts of the world had the similar idea. Like there's a thing called the Koteka, which is, yeah, it's there are communities in New Guinea that wear these. And because we're in person, oh, I can show you this. Yeah,
it looks like it's like a gourd, I would say. It's definitely made of a gourd.
Yeah.
And it's something that with a waistband that you would attach to your waist. Yeah. And, you know, it's a giant thick picture, a giant gourd that's painted, you know, ornately that you're wearing on the outside of your clothes in your area.
Yeah. Yeah, it is made from a dried out gourd, but we're saying the codpiece idea is a revelation that multiple men have thought of.
Parallel thinking, man. Parallel right. thinking.
How do I get people to notice my junk more?
Notice me!
Notice my junk! Yeah. So this, thank goodness that this didn't, you know, carry on, right? But we do have to talk about something else. Especially in the, not in the, all of the world, but especially in the late Middle Ages and in London, things were filthy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was gross. There's a whole episode of Ridiculous History on the great stink of London.
Real
you
thing.
Might recall. And that great stink in question was the Thames and just the streets because they didn't have indoor plumbing. It was just like, you know, privies, these like open pots, and they would just get dumped out into the street, you know, like a spittoon. But it was, instead of, you know, being full of gross like tobacco spit, it's full of like poop and urine. And it's just literally the streets are flowing with excrement. And the Thames is absolutely just, you know, festering with toxic runoff from leather, man, because, you know, all the chemicals used to cure leather and animal waste and animal carcasses and parts and guts coming out of butcher shops. I mean, it was bad and it smelled. And to make it worse, people didn't wash.
It wasn't as easy to wash, you know, like unless you live next to a clean water source or unless you are, I don't know, it just wasn't normalized. But at the same time, people like when we say the streets were filthy, there, you know, as Noel said, there's no sewage. There's the sewer is the middle of the street.
Right.
And the buildings are also often built such that the second floor protrudes over the first floor. So it also restricts airflow. And this leads to the reason this is such a perfect storm is because at the time people believed that you could, the current medical theory was that you could get disease through something called miasma, that smelling something meant it was going into you.
Not to mention, you know, accurately, I would argue, they believed you could get these diseases through your skin and also through bodily orifices, openings, you know, natural openings in the body. Depending on what disease we're talking about, what kind of contact, that can be true and can be not true, right?
Right.
But they washed infrequently, and so the closest thing they had, now infrequently means frequently, does they didn't wash that much, and they got around this, or at least the closest thing they had to personal hygiene was washing their garments, their undergarments, as much as possible. But even that, again, because of the availability of clean water, that's why they were using urine, by the way, partially. It was hard to do that as well, especially for the underclass. I always think of the scene in Monty Python, The Holy Grail, where somebody says something to the effect of, oh, he must be a king because he's not covered in shit.
Huh. Yeah, right. That's a pretty good line. And look, we're not saying people were purposefully, you know, incredibly dirty or filthy. We're saying it was harder to stay clean.
Correct.
And now we enter in a time where, this is weird, things become a little bit more modest. People are putting away their pretend phalluses, and men in Europe are starting to wear these long cotton linen, or if you're fancy, silk draws.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say draws for the rest of the episode. And in the most common, the thing that was sort of like the Honda Civic of underwear at this time was a knee-length garment with a button flap at the front. This was the ancestor of something that was called, I don't know why I love this name, the Union Suit, or a Union Suit.
That's the thing you picture like an old prospector wearing with the butt flap.
Right. And for some reason, it's red usually. And you get
why?
Yeah. And
maybe they washed it in the clown pants.
Pink lemonade.
Pink lemonade. Yeah.
And this later evolved into what we recognize as long johns. Have you guys ever had a pair of long johns, or do you ever wear thermal underwear?
That's right. They call them thermal underwear now. No, I haven't really lived in cold enough area to really warrant it, but I know they can be comfy. Max?
Yes, yes. So Alex and I are actually from Detroit originally. So yeah. From birth, we had long johns, and then we moved down here, and we're like, why do we still have these? It is like 900 degrees every day. More realistically, like 95 degrees and horribly humid.
It gets cold here, though, in the winter. And I, you know, certainly, if let's say you don't have central heat, for example, long johns or thermal underwear would certainly be a, you know, pretty affordable fix.
I wear them every winter. I don't tell you guys because it's a weird thing to say in conversation.
How would it come up? You know, it's hard. How do you just bring it up out of nowhere?
Well, you know, if we're hanging out, we're sitting out on the patio of our favorite wing spot or something, and it has come up once, maybe not with you guys, but someone's like, oh, it's cold, we should go in. And I was like, I'm fine. And I picked the weirdest, dumbest flex I did that winter. I was like, because I always wear thermal underwear when it's cold.
Ooh.
I was like, would you like to see? And I pulled up my shirt while everyone was saying no.
Can I say, Ben, you made a really good point that things took a turn toward the more modest.
Yes.
I think that's largely for men. For women, that's when you did start to see the push-up of the plunging neckline, and also more kind of ancient Greek and art-inspired drapings. And, like, you know, if you look at the way art evolved, I believe it was neoclassicism, where it showed a lot more of these garments with, you know, where you could literally see nipples, you know? It was very sheer and things like that. So that was something that we would start to see. But with men, they did start to cover up more. Also, the shifts we talked about, that became a weird flex in and of itself. Like in the Victorian age, you think of those like crazy, like Dilophosaurus from Jurassic Park, like neck fringes or whatever.
The ruffs. Yeah,
the ruffs, they called them. That was just the part of the shift that you could see.
Yes, yes.
Because it was, and then, you know, they would get more and more elaborate because these Richies just wanted to like one up each other and flex harder with these bizarro, you know, like halo looking things.
Exactly. And at the same time that these different things are occurring and that we're seeing a little bit of divergence, we're also seeing the end of an era, because up to about the 19th century in Europe and North America, underwear was thought to have two main functions for the average person. First, it wasn't really meant to protect you as much as it was meant to protect your outer clothes from you, because people didn't bathe and they didn't want to get their nice outside clothes dirty. So they put on their, you know, like this airlock for filth. And because, and then, you know, bathing was very much a luxury. And so in these colder climes, especially like, you know, modern day Detroit, this added an important extra layer of insulation. Noel, is it time to shout out, before we go to the next phase, is it time, we should probably mention Fruit of the Loom started around this time, right? 19th century?
Yeah, it was around midway through the 19th century. In 1851, the Fruit of the Loom Company was founded, but they didn't trademark their brand, their ubiquitous brand. And that, I always think of that, the image associated with it.
I love when the people
basket
are
of fruit.
Dressed up like the fruit. I always wanted one of those costumes, you know what I mean? I like mascots. I like stuff with mascots.
100%. And I also think it's interesting, too, not to get too far ahead. This is way far ahead. But we talk about underwear as being like something you hide. But I always thought it was awesome when we were kids, you know? You get those Fruit of the Looms that have like cartoon characters and stuff printed on them.
Oh, I miss
it. Who is that for? I guess it's just for us. You know, they don't really expect you to be parading around in your skivvies. But at the same time, it's certainly a good selling point for us kids. But you're right. In 1856, they did trademark that brand. And now, zoom, zip, zow, in the magic of podcasting and time travel through history, we are in the industrial era.
Yes, the industrial era, the industrial revolution, and your tuchus. Odds are the undergarments that you're rocking today as you listen to this, if you are indeed wearing undergarments, came to you courtesy of the Industrial Revolution. After this period, right, we see this massive expansion of commercial and manufacturing scale, and we see the ability to make instead of laboriously doing things in a very slow manner, now we can make hundreds, thousands, millions of undergarments, and cotton especially helped democratize these fabrics. So the
and that's because of the cotton gin that allowed you to process that cotton much more efficiently. And yes. Then you had things like the spinning jenny, which was like, you know, basically an industrial loom, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly. Because they had these technological breakthroughs, it became less expensive to create quality clothing, right? And then, I don't know if you were expecting this to show up in the show, folks, but then the invention of the bicycle inspires a revolution in underwear, which is the jockstrap.
Mm-hmm.
It's called a jockstrap because they called people who were on bicycles jockeys.
Yeah, were they like, I mean, they had to have been doing this for, you know, business purposes, right? Were they like delivering things on bicycles, or was it just like people riding as a mode of transportation? So there was enough demand for it that they were getting their junk rattled, you know? I mean, I have a bike and I don't have a jock strap, don't require one, but I have a memory, you know, gel kind of seat topper to protect my little Aussie.
Yeah, they didn't have that. So you're right. It must have been a problem, and you know, the jock strap is still around today because it works. And this is interesting because with the industrial era also comes the rise of capitalism. And one aspect of capitalism is to generate as many markets as possible, right? Mm-hmm. Why sell one kind of thing when you could sell the same thing four ways to four different groups? And that's why, I would argue, that's why we see this specialization in underwear, at least as a selling point.
Right? Absolutely. The differentiation between underwear for men and underwear for women, which again created these two markets. So what do you do when you specialize? You start to get real specific and you start to sell people the idea of beauty or the idea of fashion, right? So that's when you start seeing things like lingerie. And that represented a really, really great article, by the way, on Love to Know, fashion-history.lovetoknow.com, about the history of lingerie by Carolyn Cox. And she points out very astutely that the popularizing of lingerie kind of happened hand in hand with women becoming freed from some of those constraints that we talked about in terms of morality, notions of sexuality. They should, you know, kind of be more restrained, right? And this kind of became part of what led to like the sexual liberation and the idea of femininity and identity and sexual identity, or in parallel with the kind of emerging of sexual identity among women and femininity and the idea of, you know, kind of tossing off some of those Victorian morals that were sort of kind of foisted upon them. But it was the early 1900s, and there was still kind of, we weren't fully into the sexual revolution yet, but this was definitely laying the groundwork, and lingerie was considered something that was only for married couples. If you wore it and you were not a married woman, then that would be considered
low or promiscuous or in some way lacking in virtue and decorum.
There's a really great quote from a fashion journalist from 1902 that, again, is cited in this fashionhistory.lovetoknow.com article, and it goes like this. Lovely lingerie does not belong only to the fast. Dainty undergarments are not necessarily a sign of depravity. The most virtuous of us are now allowed to possess pretty undergarments without being looked upon as suspicious characters.
Hear, hear.
Caveats, but
sure.
Heading in the right direction.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, this is like this idea of to the morality jail with you based on your dress is it's dumb. It's an attempt to control people. And unfortunately, it's not the only example of its kind. We know it occurs in other countries, other cultures throughout history. People have been attempting to control each other through their dress. But this is why we have to examine all of these things at once. If we check in to see what's going on with pants and pants in the U.S. sense with trousers, then we see that, one of my favorite fun facts, Long John's, named after a real guy. His name is John L. Sullivan. He was a boxer in the 1800s, and one of his flexes was he would show up in the ring in his Long John's to box people. And then we also know the origin of the word pants. Using pants like this might be hilarious for some of our British listeners, but it comes from an Italian comedy called Pantalone. The character in this play wears these garments that come down to his ankles at a time when most folks were rocking stuff that came down to their knees. And then in the 18th century in England, these were called pantaloons. By the 19th century, we started shortening that word to pants. And then in Britain, at least, according to localhistories.org, pants came to mean just any kind of long draws. I'm still going to stick with draws that covered the entirety of your leg. And the things that you wore over those long draws, those long johns, would become known as trousers. So there it is. Also, if you go back to magic of time travel, if you go to the 1920s, you'll see pants as a pants design, pants aesthetics, again got an idea from boxing of all places. A guy named Jacob Golom developed a featherweight version of fighting shorts. And then in the 1930s, its primary villain appeared. Max, can we get some dramatic music? That's right. Oh, is that the... Okay. All right. You know what? Yeah, I'm budget conscious. I gotcha. yes, the briefs. This is a question that you hear if you're... You probably heard this pretty often. If you're male identified, people will ask you, boxers or briefs? They'll still ask you that today.
It's almost cliche, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of like a sort of flirtatious thing someone might ask you, perhaps, maybe, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
A little bit forward, a little cheeky.
Like... You know, depending on how well you know your close male friends, I'm sure at some point everybody's had that talk. It's kind of like a high school, middle school talk where you're like, oh, yeah, you wear tidy whities, your boxer guy. And there's an interesting thing that happened with a public image of tidy whities. But first, Noel, I think we need to talk a little bit about how this boxers versus briefs rivalry came to be. This was 1935. Okay, cast your memory back there. Jockey briefs go on sale in Chicago. They're designed by a guy named Arthur Niebler, who calls himself an apparel engineer. These first under... It's so hard because we're in the same room together, so I keep wanting to like stand up and demonstrate stuff, but don't worry.
Whoa,
we're a family show. So these were the first underpants that didn't have any legs, unlike a lot of those other designs, and they had... Their flap was this Y-shaped opening, and this was so revolutionary for the Little Australia business that it's been compared with the invention of the bra.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Ben, have you seen the show Trailer Park Boys?
Yes, yeah.
Randy is one of my favorite characters, the guy who's never wearing a shirt.
Yeah.
Whenever he wants to fight, he always takes his pants off because it gives him more freedom of movement to kind of like gyrate around.
Yeah.
And that's what briefs did, right? They gave you more freedom of movement because you're not restricted because they just come right up to the joints of your legs as opposed to like coming down further. I personally, I'm going to put it out there, boxer brief guy. Boxer brief guy. I like the tight fit, but I also like a little on the leg.
I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I guess if we're putting all our draws on the table, I tend to go boxer briefs myself.
Mm-hmm.
This one, though, the jockey briefs that are sometimes called tidy whities, they sold like hot cakes for your butt. The 30,000 were sold, and then
In just a couple months.
Yeah, exactly. In 3 months. And then they they started leveraging marketing in a brilliant way. They had a plane that would make special deliveries of what they called masculine support briefs to businesses across the state. And they called the plane the Mascule Line.
Okay.
You have to have the pause.
You do. Yeah. What is that print like, Ben? Is it like separated by a hyphen or something? What's the branding here?
I think they do have a hyphen. Okay. They do have a little dash because they're really proud of that name.
I get it. And they promised to deliver masculine support.
Yes.
Again, part of why it was such a revolutionary development because it, you know, gave you support, male support. And that's why you connected it with the bra, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. And so the battle for supremacy over what dudes would wear down south continued for the rest of the 20th century. And then it started to get weird because people were making these health claims.
Mm-hmm.
And these are health claims that I am sure you, Max, and I all heard growing up, where people will say, hey, well, if you, and we're endeavoring to be honest here, folks.
You're talking about the angle of the dangle?
The angle of the dangle is a big, big one, you know, and the idea, what, explain that one.
Oh, well, just like, you know, some folks are hardcore evangelists for boxers because they think you need more hangy to promote, you know, I guess, procreation. Like maybe if your stuff is too tightly packed, then it can overheat. I don't know exactly. Is that the hygiene? Maybe you can get infections. Yeah, maybe if it's like too tightly packed and you're getting hot, it's getting sweaty down there, it can cause some hygiene issues as well.
But then the fans of the brief would argue other stuff and they would say, well, here, okay, this is one I heard. I don't know if those common, but I heard, and I'm sure this is not scientifically sound. I had some folks tell me in middle school that if you wore boxers over time, what would happen is that your cod pieces would continue to drop.
Descend.
Yeah. You know, just like how sometimes when people are elderly, sometimes their ears keep growing, you know?
And wobbling to and froing.
Yes, exactly. And I do have a parody version of that.
I know the one.
Oh, you've heard the one. Yes.
Do your bees hang low? Do they wobble to and fro? It's something that happens, I think, as you get older, too. That happens there.
That's gravity.
It's just gravity. You can't mess with gravity. No amount of technological garment innovation can mess with gravity.
Exactly. And so because of these health claims, regardless of their veracity, a lot of people felt like they had their well-being at stake. And this is where we get to, I think we switch back for a second and let's talk about World War I, because it played a role in undergarments.
Super interesting. Let's not forget, like corsets, you know, you picture corsets and you picture petticoats, and that covered a pretty large swath of history, right? Like, you know, the Old West, for example, the frontier. Even though they were stepping through streets that were like covered in mud and you know, horse manure, they were still wearing these bizarre bell-shaped, you know, petticoats that were at this point surrounded by steel, right? We initially, in the early days of them, they were made with reeds or willow rods that could be bent because they were flexible. But because of the war effort, women were discouraged. It actually caused a sea change in fashion because all of that steel was needed for the war effort. So women were discouraged by the government from buying these corsets, which essentially caused a sea change in manufacturing and style. And it also saved the government 28,000 tons of metal.
Amazing, right? And no, that's no small effort. And that's where the new brassiere comes into play. And then we see a cavalcade of other innovations. Garter belts. Girdles to replace corsets.
Irma girdles. I got to say real quick, this is from some of these facts here are from a great article on Family Tree magazine called The Revealing History of Underwear by David A. Frixel, which is a great last name.
Yes, shout out to you, Mr. Frixel. Also, we see nylon stockings. We see 64 million pairs of those sold, such that kind of like the PS5 of 2021, manufacturers couldn't keep up with demand. And at some point, some people were actually painting on stockings, which is, I think, interesting.
It is interesting. And remember, you know, originally stockings were made of silk, which was a very, you know, rare and expensive material. Nylon really democratized the wearing of stockings. And I have very distinct memories of being a kid and those stockings that came in like the egg. You know, you'd buy them, it almost looked like an Easter egg.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the brand, but it really became a fashion thing, especially kind of in the 80s maybe is when I picture it, like shoulder pads and nylon stockings. But obviously it was big before that. But here's something that I didn't realize.
Oh, wait, before we go. I realized that's why they were called legs, like like eggs.
With two G's.
Yeah.
Boom.
That's why they were sold that way.
You nailed it. Very clever.
That's insane.
Very clever branding. But here's something I didn't know. The thong. Let's talk about the thong. It gets its own song.
Let me see the
thong. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you who didn't want to see that thong. Well, actually, he did. No, let me rephrase that. The mayor of New York in the 1930s, the guy who the airport's named after, Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia. There's a huge like red light district. I mean, you know, sex work was not legal, but there were lots of burlesque type joints, strip clubs, right? Times Square used to be lousy with them up until I think the 90s, you know, when they kind of, I think it was Giuliani, who cleaned up, quote unquote, cleaned up Times Square, turned it into basically like Disneyland for tourists. It's a little weird. I vaguely remember growing up going to New York in the 90s and the trashier, dirtier version. Yeah. But LaGuardia ordered by like statute, I guess, strippers to replace their G-strings, which is, you know, it's like a thong, but it's literally a string. It's basically how they could get around with them not being fully nude.
It doesn't look comfortable.
No, it doesn't look comfortable.
I've never worn one, but it doesn't look comfortable.
I haven't either, but the thong is just, it's honestly, full circle, kind of back to the loincloth.
It kind of is,
it's like a mass-produced loincloth that's stretchy, and it, you know, shows enough of the butt, but it's not like, it doesn't disappear into the butt entirely, right?
Yep, and years later, the 4811 original Rise thong in 1986.
What is this, like a jet?
it's a jet for your butt.
The 4811 Model 2 Mach 3 thong.
Mm-hmm. Now with ICBMs. Yeah, it gets accepted. It gets widespread acceptance as underwear. Just like you said, it's a loincloth. There was something else interesting we found here. Before the 1950s, pretty much everybody thought of t-shirts the way that we would think of underwear.
Correct.
Like you would, if you were a normal person, you would only be wearing a t-shirt if you were doing hard labor, playing sports. And the fact that like right now, let's see, Noel, you're wearing a t-shirt. Max, you're rocking a tee. I've got one on, but I've got one on underwear style, I guess.
But you're also wearing a polo on top of that, which is a style of tee with just like a collar.
There it is. Yeah, exactly. And that would have been unusual. We would have looked out of place.
Or way too informal.
That's the thing, way too informal. Except for the intervention of a guy named Marlon Brando in 1951, he started appearing in these canonical classic hits like Streetcar Named Desire, just wearing a tight t-shirt, showing off, you know, showing off his bod a little bit. And then he did The Wild One, where he also wore a t-shirt. James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause, also a t-shirt. And now a t-shirt becomes an everyday thing that people wear.
And you got to think, I'm just kind of spitballing here, but it was probably designed, I don't think they fully understood the pop culture phenomenon that it would create. I think initially it was probably like, this is an everyman. You know, the guy in Streetcar is meant to be kind of a working stiff, you know? So it's probably like, okay, this is what like, you know, it was meant to show his
class.
He's
not rich.
He's not rich, exactly. Yeah. Same with Rebel Without a Cause, although I think he had rich parents. That's a really interesting movie. I need to watch that one again. Mm-hmm. It's a lot weirder than I thought. It opens with this weird little clown thing, like a little clown toy, and it's very interesting, odd movie. I assumed it was going to be all motorcycle racing and bravado, but it's actually a very nuanced and strange film. Highly recommend. It also has a really great sequence that takes place at my favorite place in Los Angeles, the Griffith Park Observatory.
Ah, yes. And if whether you're at Los Angeles, New York, or anywhere between in the 1960s, you notice something called the sexual revolution. This also revolutionized social attitudes toward unmentionables. And so it's important to note that a lot of things that would have formerly been considered scandalous are now increasingly being considered mainstream, right? And now we see that underwear sometimes followed larger trends in outer clothing. Like when in the UK, when I think it was maybe the 80s, 70s, there was a move toward tight jeans. And so people went back to briefs because they couldn't put their boxers in the tight jeans without looking really awkward and weird. And then I found this really interesting quote where a person named Elizabeth Eliasson of Bjornborg, and to be clear, Bjornborg is a company named after the tennis player, said that all the underwear trends started in the 1980s with the gay market. They wanted to have innovative products. And because of this, you would see, like, there was a sexualization. You see, like, Marky Mark and designers like Calvin Klein are using pretty much nude models in their ads. And also people start associating boxers with kind of like success. This is the grown man's panties.
No, it's very true. And you know, I got to say too, Ben, you're talking about those tight jeans and having to wear briefs under them. Essentially, we've come full circle again. And that's sort of the modern codpiece.
Yes, the modern codpiece. This is where we also see this strange shift in aesthetic, or the strange shift in
a shift.
Yes, there we go. The strange chemise in this, in cultural perspective, because for a time, boxers, you know, they're becoming associated with, as we said, more well-to-do, up-and-coming, like yuppie types. They're the grown man's panties. And conversely, briefs are seen as like the underwear of boys.
Children.
Yes, of children.
Hence like the G.I. Joe prints and all of that stuff, mm-hmm. right?
It became seen like a sign of immaturity.
Exactly. But then enters Marky Mark and, mm-hmm. and Calvin Klein.
Yeah.
Or actually, you know what I always think of when I think of Calvin Klein? I think of Back to the Future when she pulls his, you know, his mom in the in the past.
Yeah.
You know, he's unconscious because I guess he gets hit by her parents' car, and then she takes his pants off and she says that his name is printed in his underwear. And she calls him Calvin for the whole movie.
Yeah.
But this changes exactly then, right around then,
right.
because of Calvin Klein and featuring, you know, the idea of an underwear model. That wasn't even a thing, you know, but maybe it was, but this is really when it becomes front and center and on billboards and on TV commercials and like all over the place and sort of normalizes that sexuality, much to the chagrin of certain evangelical sets, I would imagine, right?
Yeah. Now, underwear is not just functional. It's a statement about sex, fashion, money, and your appeal. And so seeing celebrities wearing these garments would cause people to run out and get their own, or maybe get some for their partners, right? And buy clothing for them. So this translates directly to sales. Mm-hmm.
And that was starting in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
And going through to the 80s when that was probably at its peak with the Marky Mark stuff. Well, that was also like, I don't know, Marky Mark would probably have been like late 80s, like early 90s.
Yeah, I think
that
so.
Really never went away.
No, no. And now we're reaching the conclusion of our tale for now. There is a future of underwear that we'll cover, I guess, much, much later. But as you know, one of our favorite arbitrary rules here on Ridiculous History is that we consider history stuff that happened before about the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. Max, did we tell you that?
I don't think you guys did tell me that.
Oh, yeah, that's the cutoff.
Our cutoff is apartheid.
Our cutoff is literally, yes. And that's why we're stopping at this era, the hybrid boxer brief. There's so many more. Noel, you and I did a roundup of some just interesting underwear facts that we found.
Dude, this first one almost makes me think George Lucas was a little bit of a perv.
So the story is unconfirmed that Carrie Fisher didn't wear underwear while filming Star Wars because George Lucas told her, "There is no underwear in outer space."
Okay, George. Whatever, man.
Come on, George.
I mean, it's the future, man. There's future underwear.
I would like to point out that at no point in Star Wars do they say it's the future.
Well, actually, it's supposed to have happened a long, long time ago.
Ha-ha! In a galaxy far, far away. It's true. You know, sticking with maybe a military-type theme, the expression of going commando apparently mm-hmm. first started being used in the 70s as, like, university slang, like in frat-type circles. One of the first mentions apparently occurred at the University of North Carolina back in 1974, but it refers to, of course, the idea of a commando, a military man, being ready to go at a moment's notice and not needing to put on drawers.
Ah, okay, that's illuminating. Okay. It's also illegal in Thailand to leave your house without underwear. And also, I found—
Don't they also execute you for smoking pot in Thailand?
It does have harsh drug laws. If you're traveling to a place that says they have harsh drug laws, just believe them.
Yeah.
Just believe them. You know what I mean? You could party at home. But also, one thing I thought would be fun for us to do, if you were interested, is I was looking for underwear slang.
Mm-hmm.
Because whenever we talk about things that are like the, ooh, naughty stuff, we always find all this beautiful language about it. Like Benjamin Franklin's long list, his reference work that's just phrases for getting drunk, or all the various names people have for genitals. We found some cool underwear slang. One of them is pretties, which I think is so creepy.
Yeah, that's super creepy. We've also got—
Let me see your pretties.
Oh my goodness, get my pretty. That's not cool. Then, of course, you know, we've got some, there's different ones from different regions. Like you said, we've got things like granny panties. We've got drawers, of course. We've got briefs, thongs, G-strings, pantaloons. What else we've got? Wiener basket.
Oh, finally. Finally, that's high class.
Banana hammock?
Yeah, I've heard that there's tap pants, which were for tap dancers. Cutty sark, is one.
That's also a scotch. A whiskey, right? Yeah, whiskey, right. Budgie smugglers.
Mm-hmm.
Manhole covers.
Manhole covers is clever. Of course, knickers is good, and that has its own interesting history. But my heart goes to the union suit.
I love the union
suit. I just want to start referring to that. Like, I'm wearing my union suit.
My union suit. It's covering your birthday suit.
It covers your birthday suit. Well done.
Got a couple more dumb ones just from Bellatory.com. We've got sausage skins, kecks, underoos, mantis, truncheon holder, grundies, trolleys, and skivvies.
I'm gonna try to make some up. Max, you can just rate these with sound cues. How about your hands free?
Yeah.
There you go, because otherwise you'd have to just hold them, right?
It's true. Yeah. Okay. Fig leaf.
There we go. Your crossroads? No, that's weird.
That's a really good movie with Britney Spears in it.
Okay, well, we'll take that. And I think that's
and
our show.
It's a great Bone Thugs and Harmony song. And have a really great version of it about Chick-fil-A.
I do. I love that version. Maybe one day we'll all be able to play it together and not get sued by one of those giants.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Gosh, this is a fun one. Thank you to Fruit of the Loom, first and foremost.
Thank you. Please send me one of those fruit mascot costumes.
Oh, man.
I wouldn't be the grape.
We'll wear it on a soon to be announced live event that we're going to do.
Oh, wow. Yeah, if they still let us do it after this
episode. Thanks to you, Ben. Thanks to you, Max Williams, super producer Max Williams, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, super producer Casey Pegram, all the super producers of days of yore.
Yes, and thanks to you, Noel. It's great to hang out in person. Thanks to Gabe Lussier, our research associate, Christopher Asiotis, Eve's Jeffcoat, and thanks to
Jonathan Strickland.
And thanks to, yeah.
Keeping
and
our
thanks,
voices down.
Yeah,
voices
well, that's the second time we said the name, so we can power through this. Thanks to the Quister, for sure. And then, you know, thanks to all the people who have tirelessly worked to make underwear better, honestly. Because if you look at the history, this is a wild ride.
It really is. See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.